shall overcome.
Incredibly courageous for Bishop Derry to get up. I mean, we wouldn't have got up if he hadn't taken the lead.
Was total silence, a neary silence, and all I could hear was a woman behind a telephone box crying. That was my bloody Sunday.
We since discovered at least one MI5 agent who was in the bogside in the week before. What were you doing there? What did you report back to your superiors?
My family have been destroyed by bloody Sunday.
Well, what happened was there was a parade. It was stopped, and there was CS gas and dye used on the people. Then the people moved back again, and a lot of people were looking around waiting to see what was going to happen. And suddenly, I saw at least three or four Saracens came dashing into Roswell Street, into the Bogside area. Everybody ran, and the army opened fire. There was no fire before that at all of any kind of the army. There had been a few stones thrown earlier, but apart from that, certainly at the time they opened fire with guns, there was nothing thrown at them at all. Everybody was running away from them. And this young boy, the one thing that I witnessed was this young boy was running beside me and he fell. He was shot dead. I attended him. And it was just cold-blooded murder, nothing else.
And so all the shooting that you saw today was unprovoked?
Well, the shooting by the army, certainly, at the early period that I saw, was certainly, they were the only people that were shooting. There was nobody shooting at them at all. Nothing at all. None at all.
And in the evening news, the Brits did what they do best. They got the word out first, and they said that their troops engaged in a gun battle, the IRA, and Derry that night. And the people they killed were all gunmen and bombers. And the British Embassy released it through around the world. And the New York Times ran with it the following day, with all the names of the dead, naming them as gunman and nail bomber. You can say what you want about the dead. And they knew it. They libeled the dead. And they knew they could get away with it. And we were left chasing the lie for 40 years.
Unfortunately, you were quite aware that because the British Army were appearing on television, representatives telling lies, telling their side of the story and about all these gunmen, when I had been there and didn't see any gunmen, that it was so frustrating that you had to live and look at national television telling lies.
The way that the British described the events of Bloody Sunday was in many ways worse than the actual massacre itself, because you had to live with the obvious lies and propaganda that were spread at the time, and that had a very, very damaging effect, I think, on how people saw themselves in relation to the state and the expectation or no expectation of justice.
My next task was to get my film to UPI, which was the client I was taking pictures for. Back then, the way to do that was to go to Alder Grove, get the film on a plane to London. And one of my concerns was, will I run into more roadblocks? Will my film be seized? I made sure that I had my various rolls of film in different parts of my car. I mean, that's not much security, but it was the only thing that I could in case I was searched. I was actually kind of surprised that driving back to Alder Grove was totally uneventful.
Over the army broadcast, which they listened into, had given an order to arrest the Italian journalist without whatever means necessary. And they explained to me that whatever means necessary, intended that they could even shoot at me. What they were after was obviously not so much my person, but what I had assembled in terms of photographs and recordings.
You give him the helmet, he'll get the mic.
Okay, great.
Let me get the mic yourself.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
Well, night came and over, and it was decided that I should reach Dublin in order to provide this material. And there was a young couple of young Derry people who drove me over the border. And at the other side of the border had been arranged for another car to take us to Dublin for dawn and before the first newspaper would appear. And but the top of all misfortunes, the car broke down on the way. But we were given lifts by other people who understood what was at stake. And they took us to Dublin, and I got to the Irish Press. So I gave them my pictures, and they immediately published a second edition of the newspaper with all the pictures that I had taken. And then they urged me to continue to the Irish television, where also I was taken into a studio, and they asked me to report. And again, they too showed the pictures, but this time accompanied with a very, very dramatic recording of the shooting and of the despair, of the shouting of these people. And somehow it stood opposed to what the official version as decided by the London government.
Jesus Christ! What got carried in that house? Look here, another one.
Hey, can nobody get an ambulance?
Go!
These days, with a mobile, you can basically record, edit, and send out fairly good quality audio from practically anywhere where you can get a signal. Back then, if you talked into a public telephone and it was recorded a few hundred or a few thousand miles away, you get a fairly tinny sounding voice. And so typically what I would do is obviously do the interviews on a cassette recorder, do my report on a cassette recorder. If it was possible, what you would do is unscrew the mic piece on the phone. You had a couple of little wires that plugged into your tape recorder, ended in what we called alligator clips. And you'd remove the mic from the phone, clip the alligator clips onto the little prongs that connect to the mic, and you'd get the best possible audio. And so one of the things that a radio reporter had to do in 1971, 1972, was know where the payphones were, where you could remove the mic and do that. And the only place that I knew of in Derry was in the City Hotel. So that was where there were lots of reporters. I had to wait for somebody to be done, got to the payphone, called up UPI, and I filed my report and sent in some audio.
A number of civilians have been killed by the British Army during this city's worst day of violence. The day started with a peaceful but illegal civil rights march in which about 20,000 people took part. When the march reached an army barricade near the city center, troops used tear gas and a water cannon. The shooting started while the marchers were retreating. The army claims snipers started the shooting, but army fire was far heavier and was directed at civilians. Besides those killed, many more people were injured. William L. Rukeyser, Londonderry, Northern Ireland.
Sometime during the night, because where we lived, there was a main road just at the back of our house. The army was outside the back. They had put a checkpoint at our back gate, actually. They were out singing that there's going to be a wedding in the morning. Well, at that stage, my mother got really upset. And there was Charles Glenn would have been on the march that day. And for some reason, he was passing and he had new. And he says to them, he says, you might want to move from there. He says, it's a disgrace what you are doing on that family. So as far as I know, they did leave.
The atmosphere in the city side of the city was so tragic. And it was as if everybody was holding awake, that the whole part of the city was holding awake. And on Roswell Street, where Auntie Brady's flat was, it was continuously people there, hundreds of people coming to view where people were shot, all the press from around the world, of course. And I must say that then that for me helped Auntie Bridie, because she didn't miss anything of it. So therefore she didn't sit down to think how terrible what she had witnessed. And that for me was great, because it took the problem of looking after her out of my hands, in a sense.
So everybody knew somebody. I mean, the Bogside and Craigan and Brandy, well, which were all the people that come from, all the killed and the wounded, with one exception for a fellow who came from down the Strand Road, which was, I mean, half a mile away or something, and all the rest came from the Bogside, the Brandywell, and the Craigan. So there was nobody in the Bogside who didn't know somebody, or certainly who didn't know the family of somebody who had been killed. You know, as a, nobody, I mean, I knew three or four of them, and everybody, the Bogside, small, neighbourly, gossipy place, of course, you know, so it's a, so you could place everybody, you knew everybody, or you knew their sister, or their father, or my father would have worked with that. So things like that. So it wasn't, there had been people killed before, and there'd be a lot, you know, sort of an upsurge of sympathy for the family, the bereaved family. But this was something different, because everybody was bereaved. Everybody. Everybody you knew somebody was always, was mourning, you know, sort of. So it wasn't just a series of individual deaths and people being wounded. It was experienced as a sort of communal thing. And it really, I think that everybody felt that. Everybody. And the next morning, everybody felt this. That it was, and everybody the next morning knew the names of the dead. Knew them all. Everybody on the Bogside. I remember going down Rossler Street. Again, sort of early in the morning, sort of after Bloody Sunday, didn't know what to do. I mean, it's, the place was quite... People were walking around looking at it. I mean, looking at streets and houses, which we all knew, and knowing, sort of, there's Gilmore's house, you know, sort of, and the Nashes and the Rays. I knew Jim Ray's father very well through a tenants' association. And you know, there's Rays and so on, and going into some of the houses, and nobody knew what to do, but so they just stayed there. The place was packed with people in the morning, but very still and quiet, and hardly anybody talking. But everybody knew the names by that stage. You could have rhymed them off. You know, it's a could still rhyme them off. And we also knew, was absolutely knew deep within us, that this changed things. This was different. Things will never be the same in this town again. And that's all you can think of to say.
The whole town was numb. I remember somebody saying in an interview sometime after it, and this is days after it, people spoke in hushed tones. And I remember going to the shops the next day, and that's what happened. People weren't speaking with a loud voice anymore. They were all, it was hushed tones.
I'm the eldest in the family, and my parents wanted my brother and I to visit the other families. There was only one of those other families that we knew. We didn't live in the Bogside or Craigan. So there was only one other family that we knew, and it was Jerry McKinney's family. Now, Jerry was married, and I think he had six children at the time, and he's a little bit older than me. He didn't live there at the time of Bloody Sunday, but he would have grown up in exactly the same house as me, except in the next street. So I would have known his family. That was the only other family I would have known.
So I remember the week when Michael's body was brought home, dealing with my mother, dealing with the family. Like, I was, there were still a few of the younger ones still in the house, and they were shipped out to somebody else's house for the duration of the week. And in those days, people sat up, you know, during the night, you know, with the body and so on. So Michael was laid out in his wee bedroom. And about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, not sure what time it was, all of a sudden my mother came diving into the bedroom, ran to the coffin and lifted Michael up, shouting, Michael's son. She doesn't even remember that. She had so much medication in her, she should have slept for a week. And she didn't even remember doing that. So it was a matter of keeping an eye on her and keeping an eye on my father too as well. But during the week, hundreds of people came into the house. Hundreds, like every house. We're all the same. Everyone was the same. People coming and going. I remember John Hume coming up and giving my father a few pounds. Nobody helped to pay for the you know, the time of the week, you know, for the food and whatever it was, you know. And then watching people come and go. And fair play to people. They came in to pay their respects because they knew what happened. And Michael was an innocent young boy and he was murdered. And this was all up until Wednesday. I think it was Wednesday.
I don't remember Jackie's remains in the house. It's a kind of, it must have been done to shock or something because I don't remember the next few days after that. And one of the anniversaries, I had thought I had seen myself in a photograph outside the chapel, and the aunt that had come to tell us the news said that I had collapsed in the chapel steps and had to be taken home. I don't remember that, so that means I don't remember the funeral either.
I remember very clearly the church. I remember one of my younger sisters getting separated from us in the cemetery, and it was, I don't know what, how to describe it. It was just like, it felt like there was a million people there. I don't know how long I stayed. The morning of the funeral was very, very hard. I think our Joyce might have got lost somewhere. But I remember my mammy saying, where's our Kevin's coffin? Because we were still stuck in the chapel because there was that many people. And then finally they, for some reason, it was like a whole way parted and we just ended up catching up as our Kevin's coffin was going into the cemetery for the funerals. Was that many people there? It was horrendous. But I suppose it must have been really, really hard on my mother and father.
The funeral was devastating. I was afraid Willie coming into the house, and then I was afraid again when he was leaving the house. I didn't want to see his dead body coming in, but I didn't want to see it going then. You know, I wanted to keep it. But people were always sort of holding on to you and, you know, keeping you calm and stuff. She was in the hospital while we held the funeral. My father was also in the hospital, so none of my parents got to the funeral. I don't know if I could have coped, to be honest. I was the oldest girl. If I hadn't such good neighbours, you know, they told me to just stand at the door and greet people. I remember a man called Roy McMonagle, two doors away, and he said, "Kate, you just stand there at the door and greet people." He says, "And we'll look after the rest, you know, food and make a tea for people." But, you know, it seemed like thousands of people. It was just a steady train of people coming into the house. It was unbelievable, the amount of people.
3 or 4 days later, I was again in Derry, and I had the opportunity to meet the friends and the relatives of those wounded and killed. And I went into the houses, and they accepted, despite the situation they were in, which wasn't really ideal for receiving visitors with cameras and questions, disturbing questions. But they all were very cooperative, very friendly, as usual. As I said, the very people. So I entered the houses of the and listened to the wails, the despair, the protest, the anger, the decision to not give up. That was a common cry.
An area of which we lived in, which was down in Pennyburn, which was very, very mixed area. There would have been a lot of our Protestant neighbours that would have been in helping and doing tea and doing bits and pieces and feeding us all over the week. They were more than glad to help out, so they did. Jean come and Cahill come home. Just with that many people about the house, you didn't know what was going on. When the remains come home, it was really hard. The night before the remains were going to the chapel, there was an old car lying down the street. It had been lying for months and months. But at the time the remains were going out, Suddenly the bottom of our street was blocked off. There was supposed to be a bomb in this car that had been sitting there for 4 months. Well, whether it was done deliberately or not deliberately, it just coincided with the same time that Kevin's remains was gone out of the house. We all went to Craigan with the remains and come back. The house was just pandemonium for them a couple of days.
The day of the funerals, it was noticeably chilly. There was rain, almost freezing rain falling. It was a grim day. And remember, in Northern Ireland at that time, it was illegal to fly the flag of the Republic. But you could absolutely tell what the allegiance of various streets was, because every nationalist neighborhood had the flag flying that day.
And the end of the day of the funeral, which I don't remember that much about either, except it felt so cold having to get a ticket to go to your own brother's funeral. And it was an awfulest day. It was cold compared to actually a bloody Sunday, which was a bright, crisp winter's day. The day of the funerals, the skies never stopped. Rain, cold, wind, and that crowds outside the church. But I remember Fred Atlantic kept going to the with my brother's remains and the family to the grave where John was buried. And that was that day, which was a horrible day.
And then the day of the funerals, it was hard bringing him in, but it was hard more so parting with him. So even carrying him out of the house, I still remember some of the sisters collapsing and so on. But then we had to go to, we carried him up to the church, but we had to have tickets to get in the church because of all the dignitaries were coming from all over the country and so on. So each family was given a certain amount of tickets. And you got a ticket, you didn't get in. But after that, I didn't remember anything on the day itself about the burial or anything whatsoever. It just went past me. Yeah. If you imagine 13 coffins lying side by side, and Michael being one of them, and Michael, I always remember Michael being the third one, you know. But they actually brought the coffins up the night before because they lay overnight in the church. You know, I just remembered that. And I'm talking about not remembering the day of the burials. I don't remember a thing, the day of the burials. I remember absolutely nothing. And that's the way it was, and that was the way it was left. And the families had to just fend for themselves, just get on with it. No help, no nothing, apart from people like the likes of John Hume and others. And then there was a fund was set up for the families, and it helped to pay for the funeral expenses and so on. They got there and helped the families over the whatever period of time, because there was money coming in from all over the world. There was a fund, and there was people in the town who dealt with that and sorted the families out and so on, you know.
So I drove to the church, and at that point, it was jam-packed. They weren't admitting more people. It was already filled with families of the victims, people from the Bogside, other people who had come there early. As a member of the press, I was able to get in, but I wasn't in the main part of the church. I was back in the offices where RTE had a live broadcast going on, and they were providing audio for other reporters who were there. So I got to hear the whole thing. I didn't get to witness the service because I was in another room, but you know, it was as emotional as you can imagine. you know, there were very emotional points reading the roll call of the victims, the songs. It was just, you know, as emotional a funeral as you can imagine.
Remember, Lord, those who have died and have gone before us marked with the sign of faith, especially those for whom we now pray. Bernard McGuigan, John Young, Jackie Duddy, Jim Ray, Gerald Donaghy, Michael McDade, William McKinney, Gerald McKinney, William Nash, Kevin McElhinney, Hugh Gilmer, Patrick Doherty, Michael Kelly. May these and all who sleep in Christ find in your presence light, happiness, and peace.
I was lucky enough with my mother to be able to get into the church in Craigan where the mass funerals were held. It was a very, very cold day, and thousands of people had to stand outside. But we went early enough and got in there and witnessed the cardinal and all the priests and all the dignitaries coming for the funerals. And for a long time afterwards, that's all people could talk about.
You know, you think about them, you think about the wasted lives are extraordinary. You know, I took an interest in human rights things and, you know, and I was thinking about, from time to time, the weight of people who lost their lives, who had a lot to contribute, you know, and who never got a chance to live a life and, you know, be part of society and be part of a family and so on, you know. And him, especially at that very early age, you know.
I was in hospital for 16 weeks, I think it was, or maybe 20 weeks. I was 16 weeks then. I was like a plaster then. And I was 16 weeks. I was lying with my leg up and there was a big screw through my knee. And then they took that out, put me in a plaster. Then I was in a caliper then for weeks then. Then I went over one day and Dr. Fenton says, I don't need it anymore. But I'm still a lump to this day, you know. One leg's 3/4 inch shorter than an hour. No, any chance I had of been playing football or anything was without the wonder that day.
When my mother was in the hospital then, Bishop Daly and Rose Black, she was welfare then, no social services. They came and wanted to put us in the home because I was 13, Margie was 14, Patty was 15. And there was 11 younger than me and Margie and Patty. And we didn't want broke up, we didn't want split up or put into the home or anything. So I got leaving school at 13. Margie is 14. So me and Margie had to look after 11 children. No help from nobody. Well, my mother got out of the hospital and we had to look after her as well because she was in a wheelchair. The nuns in the school that I was at, they were the only ones really helped us to bring parcels to the house. And, you know, they were very good. But all in effort, no help from nobody. So ever, nobody.
I went back to Canada and left my parents to deal with it. We didn't have a phone, so there was not a lot of phone calls back to see how they were coping or anything. And there would usually only be phone calls at birthdays and Christmas and that kind of thing, because my mother would have to go to a neighbour's and we'd have to pre-arrange it. I kind of always think in my defence I was 23 years of age, but I did leave my parents to deal with it, and I don't. And my two sisters who were still at home, and they were still both in school. So I do have regrets about that now. But I mean, I do have regrets, but I don't beat myself up about it or whatever.
She got out, I can't remember the date exactly. She was on for a bit, but like she was on for a couple of months. And it was brilliant just getting her out home, you know. But she was never the same. Well, she had a cast on the full length of her leg. She couldn't manage at all. We had to do everything for her, to help her wash and dress, and she just couldn't do nothing for herself. And then that left her kind of down. You know, why did that soldier shoot me?
So I just got on with life as best I could. I looked after my mother. I got more calls than enough about my mother. My mother was in a terrible state, and I see me at times having to go up and argue and fight with her, not fight physically, but argue with her and try and bring her around. She went into a state crying and roaring and not knowing what to do and all that sort of stuff. Eventually, my mother ended up in the asylum, we call it here's Grandchild, know, for help. She was in that bad a state. She needed help, and that was the only way we could get her help. But thank God, you know, after she did come out of it.
The army then started the trouble. They started to ransack our house. You know, I don't know what they were looking for, but there was never nothing there. They would be standing there with big guns, you standing making the dinner and stuff. It happened so often. Up the stairs, they were dragging us out of bed. I got arrested one morning. But all of that, my brother got hit by a rifle, and he was arrested and done nothing. They never did get anything in our house, and they never would have. They would have been firing tear gas. They were firing that at our house. They were firing that at our bedrooms, you know, and calling to my mother all the time, Bridie, go and make us a cup of tea. And that drove her mad. That drove my mother mad, you know. But that's the sort of thing they done, you know. Which brawler can we take next? Which brawler do you want taken next? You know, Jesus, it was torture for years. Torture.
My mother was a very religious woman. Went to Mass every day. But after Michael died, she also went to the cemetery. She went to Mass, cemetery, every day. But one time, not long after Michael was buried, in the winter time, there was snow on the ground. And she was seen walking towards the cemetery with a blanket under her arm. And a woman approached her and said, Mrs. Kelly, where are you going with the blanket? She says, Michael will be cold. I'm taking it over to put it over his grave. You know, what sort of frame of mind could a person be in if they actually do something like that? You know, that's how devastated that she was about Michael's death.
Oh, no, she was never the same. They went to the amputate her leg. She went, she was going to the theatre and all. She signed the thing to say, aye. And she got the theatre door. She said, take me back. She says, no good on to me there, and it's no good if you throw it out and burn it. She said, I'll just keep it on there. But she had bother when she just kept taking sores after sores on it, you know. It was awful to watch her, like. And, like, our bathroom was downstairs. And when we got her upstairs, we bought a wee bucket at night for her to go to the toilet, you know. We didn't know at that time that we could have got her a commode chair, but we didn't know, and we didn't know she was tightly cares. She was only 13, 14, we wouldn't knew her damn things. It's just sad to watch her, you know, because she would have took us different places, way out walks, out the roads, and then she couldn't do none of that then after that. We were taking her walks, like in her wheelchair, you know. She says, I should be doing this for you.
The things he says about the people that died on, that he was murdered and then was injured, they were this, they were that. You look back at the records, none of his layabouts. They were all working youths and the men as well. You know, and it's a problem with that. They just walked away and left us, not as a family, as a community, destroyed. Bogside, Brandywell, Craig, and all them areas were just, what do you do? How can you get off from this? But if we did.
Well, we never took part in the riot. Never threw a stone. Never. Me and Joe did. Wally didn't. He always had an interest in recording the marches. When a protest marches, anything like that, he would record it, all that stuff. He worked in a local newspaper here. He was a typesetter there. He used to set the type and all. And I know he bought a 35mm Pentax of one of the photographers in the journal office at the time. Even when I seen it, I was sort of taken back. Oh, God, look at, you know. He used to shoot away by it there, like, you know.
My father was very much an ordinary man. He had to go and work in England at different stages of his life because he couldn't find work here. By 1969, he was working here in DuPont. He was a father of a family of six children. The oldest at the time of Bloody Sunday, I think, was 12, and the youngest was 6 months. Our Glenn was born in June 1971. But he was very much an ordinary man. He enjoyed family life. He enjoyed his work. He was very popular among his friends and neighbours, as somebody he was always keen to help out. He was a great father to us. He would have been strict and very... in a number of ways, and he didn't take no for an answer as a father. That's just the way things were at the time. There was very little explained. You were just told. I think he had a great sense of what was happening at the time as well. He was no political intellectual, but he had a great sense of what was happening at the time in terms of the civil rights, in terms of the British coming on the streets. He would have challenged British soldiers in the streets many and many an occasion. And I think on a number of occasions they come off the worst. He was very much into the civil rights and was a steward on the day of Bloody Sunday when he was executed.
And Michael was an easy come, easy go young fella. You know, there was never any trouble with Michael. He was never in trouble. He kept himself, and he was working at the time. He was being trained as a sewing machine mechanic. He was going steady. He had a girlfriend. So he was just a normal guy. He went to Belfast during the week to learn to become a sewing machine mechanic and come back at the weekend. He went to work the next morning. Then he came home, probably washed himself, got himself ready, went and met his girlfriend, went out for, you know, for a dance or something. That was his life. He actually reared pigeons. And him and my Muller actually built the pigeon shed together. And he as I said, he would take a couple of pigeons to work with him. Took them to Maidown, released them. But my Muller had to wait for those pigeons to arrive. You know, this is the sort of thing he did.
Kevin being the oldest, and with my daddy having to work night shift, Kevin was like 16, 17. Kevin would have had to do a lot of that. He would have done the washing and stuff in the house. He was the older one and a lot of the cooking. Of course, Kevin was trying to teach me and our Joyce how to cook. God love him. Stuff like that. When Kevin's clothes come home, when they were returned, our sink never seen as much salt in its life. My mother washed his clothes every day in cold water and salt. Which removed all the salt, which removed all the blood out of them. We were washed for about 3 weeks, everything was clean. And then they were all pressed and ironed and hung up in the wardrobe for a while. They hung there for a long minute's year before they went out.
Which was not like Evan. They were given to the blood. My mother's a rare blood group. And she said to the doctor, I can't take that blood. And he says, well, yeah, I'll take that, he'll die. But when they give her the blood anyway, my mother's organs started to fail. So they had to rush her to the city then. And we get up to see her then, I think it was 2 weeks after that. But she was looking at, she was lying with her eyes closed and all that stuff. She was in a wee coma, like, and she didn't wake in the whole time we were there, but we couldn't get under. We had to look through a window at her, you know. And it was just heartbreaking looking at her, like, and all these big dialysis machines. We went up then, I think it was a week or maybe 2 weeks later. And she was wakened, but she didn't know us. Didn't recognise us. And it was Father Gare took us up, and she was saying to the nurse, who's that man? Who's them people? Go and chase them away from that bundle. They're looking on at me. It was just heartbreaking, wasn't there? And then we went up then a week later or something like that there, and she knew us. And we get into the room there, but we had to wear a mask and cover our head and big gowns and things over our feet. But it was great, like, to get in to see her. And she was up here then about 5 or 6 weeks before we get on to touch her or hug her. And then she was brought down to Derry then. We seen her every day. We were in all Kevin every day then. And the wee young ones get over every day to see her as well.
William, well, we called him Willie. He was 19 years of age, just turned 19. He was a very funny guy. He had a great sense of humour. In fact, he was he would have created pranks, you know, and he would have went to some lengths, you know, to scare the sisters. But very, very funny guy. He loved music, you know, he particularly loved country and western, you know. So he would sit at night, you know, and play his music. You know, you would hear him at 10, 11, and that's when the music would be playing, you know. He went out then at the weekend, you know, and like most other young men, he would have went dancing, you know, with big dance halls then, and you know, embassy and lovely places, you know, that you could go to dance. They don't have that anymore, but Willie would go to that too, probably have a few pints, you know, with his friends, and just the usual young men sort of things, you know.
John was his own man. John had a not a plan, but he had things that he was intent on doing with his life. Like 17, he had a job, was going in a nice gear, always liked to be well-dressed and stuff like that. And it's just a normal Yuffla, they had nothing in them days, but what they had, they appreciated, you know, because it was hard earned, and it was, and he always looked after himself, and he was always in Tintin, and probably they leave Derry anyway, because my sister lived out in America then. If John had went to America, he would have made a good life for himself, because he was at Kenny Yuffla, you know. He used to go along with a band, and you go along with a band, you meet all the girls then, and the girls would approach John to get on free and all. No, all that, but he was well liked. He was that's a mirror. That's the way John would have went about there, looking with that shirt and tie on him like that. Always, he worked in a tailor shop, so he had to be forth, you know, up nice, and he was a nice looking fella when he was well dressed. He must have had five or six suits. Where nobody ever had a suit. You had to get Lenny a suit years ago if you were going somewhere.
Johnny died from his injuries a couple of months later at 59 years of age. Johnny was a very active working man. He ran a clothes shop in the city centre. So he was a fit man, played golf, a jolly man, enjoyed life, married to my Aunt Margaret, my father's sister. He lived with Margaret in the family home in the bog, in Bogside Road. And then when Hip was knocked down, the clothes shop in the bog, Margaret and Johnny. Johnny was a great salesman, but he was never a businessman. And if he had been paid for all the clothes, he let people get stuff on credit. But he never ever chased up the money. The clothes shop stopped, and the house was knocked down, and the bar, the Duddy Bar, was knocked down as well, which was run by my Aunt Eileen. They moved to Mulver Street, 1966-67. And Johnny was working in Hassan's and Fergie Street, which is just off the Diamond in Derry. And he would have treated us as his own children, because Margaret and Johnny were never blessed with children.
He was a lovely big fella. He was about 6'1", tall, very tall for the average person in Derry at that time. He was a great support to my mother, because my father had to work in England a lot. So he was like a surrogate father in a sense. Not overly so, but I mean, he didn't mess with my mum. You know, my dad wasn't there. Jim was the authority in the house, you know. And there was 9 children, so you needed to have that hand on. He was non-sectarian. He was enjoyed things. He was full of fun. And he worked hard. So I was proud to be his brother.
Kevin himself, it would have been on the music. T-Rex was his favourite band. That was his favourite one. But he would have had a lot of records. Like, we'd always had the front room where he'd had his music on. He'd have his record player. And my dad's, the piano and all would have been on there when my daddy used to play. And he'd have just been on the music. And he was only 17, so he was really only starting to kind of go out and about, because then you had to be over 18 or that before you could go out. I think it was at that age. It was very, very hard on my parents. I haven't been the only boy too left at home. Kevin himself was kind of shy. wasn't very, very, he was outgoing, but not overly. He worked in Lupton's, stacking the shelves. Thursday, he would have been off a half day on the Thursday, which would have been the day he would have done the washing and stuff like that. And his nickname would have been Froggy, for whatever reason. I don't know. A lot of the boys around there would have called him Froggy. They also, was just our big brother. He would have looked after us. He would have done the babysitting, like if me and my daddy were going out. If we were going out for a night for an hour or two.
I remember when we first got married, myself and Jean, we had a wee flat. It was in Mulber Street. And when we moved down to it on a Saturday, and I went up to Margaret and Johnny and was telling them we'd moved in. So Johnny was out working the garden, it was May. So Johnny went out and got a bunch of flowers, walked down in front of myself and Margaret with the flowers held out in front of him. And back then, men didn't walk around with flowers. You know, if men got a bunch of flowers, they would have got them covered up completely. They wouldn't have been walking down the street. But that was the kind of Johnny. He was that type of man. He didn't care. He was a romantic, great big character.
But Jackie was one of a large family. He was a typical young brother. He was quite good looking. He had girlfriends. But Jackie, it worked. It was... He worked in a garage for a while and then he went down to French's factory. He was learning a trade as a weaver. And whether he would have continued that trade or not also remains to be seen. But he had a great passion for amateur boxing. And for some reason that we're not 100% sure about, he joined the Long Tower Boxing Club, which was a wee bit away from Craigan. But it... He just loved bringing his trophies home to me, Daddy. People have asked me since what titles did he won and all. But all I remember is him coming home with these trophies and being as happy, being able to give me Daddy these trophies that he'd won at the boxing. And we'll never know whether Jackie would have went on to become an Olympic boxer, whether he'd have become a professional boxer.
He was interested in boxing. He went to the same club as Charlie. And they would have sparred together, you know, and kidded one another around. Sometimes the thump might have been too hard, you know. But that's the way they went on, you know. But he worked in the docks too, along with my father. My father was always very proud of his strength. My father used to say, "Well, he's strong arms. He's got strong arms, you know." But for his life, he was kindly, very generous, you know. For his life, I would imagine, he wasn't going to university. There was no chance of that. But he was a hard worker, you know, so he's somebody who would have succeeded in that way in life, you know.
Michael was Michael. Myself and him was a couple of years apart, and both of us from an early age worked after school. Mickey was a bit older, and then when he left school, he got a job, what you would call, it was Bradley's. They owned a grocer's. And they owned a public house. They say one another, I was just round the corner from where we lived. And I got a job on there in the grocery department. It was just a wee small local shop, like, but it was a groceries. He had worked on there for a couple of years. He was very mild, easy going, enjoyed a bit of crack. He got a job in the bar then. And as time went on, he done a lot in that short period of time. And he ended up running the pub for the family that owned it.
My family was more important. My brothers and sisters was more important than school. But sure, years later then, when I had my own family back to school when I was 40, I got myself, I was ended up a cook again. So I don't know, right? I was able to read and write down. Maybe I didn't have to go back to school to learn to read and write because I was able to, we learned each other and we had to learn the younger ones. So we all learned each other, really. It's sad, but... We done it. We have no other choice, really. How to do it. And I would do it again.
So Jim died, murdered when he was 22 years of age. Just about to get married, engaged to an Israeli girl too. A lovely girl she was, Miriam. His life just about to take off in an adult sense with all the expectations about that was just snatched away from him. A loving brother. A son. My mother died within 2 years. The death certificate will say cancer. And I can tell you it was a power bullet. The effect it had on our family. My father totally embittered my father. My younger siblings were badly affected by it. I was very fortunate. I was 18 at the time. If I had wanted to be violent, nobody would have touched me anyway because they said there was vengeance, so I was lucky. I was very lucky. But I see that many of my contemporaries of the time who were angered and all joined organisations, and they had a love of that consequence on their lives, and still some of them live with it today.
The other thing, we never talked much about it in the house because my daddy had this fear that the other boys would maybe go out and look for retaliation or whatever. So we never really got a chance much to talk about what had happened, why it happened. Politics wasn't allowed to be talked about in the house because it could cause trouble. Football was another one that could cause trouble. And, you know, there was only wee guidelines like this, and this is how we love our life.
Because at this particular point in time, I'm not happy. My family's not happy with the outcome. Even Savile, you know, it was a great thing to have it, something we thought we'd never get. But we got it. But he didn't say what he should have said to me. Like, my brother was, we're not unjust or unjustified, but my brother's murder was pure murder. And anybody was wounded in that day, it wasn't, there's no justification or unjustification or on anything that he says and his outcome. It was murder, an attempted murder of men, women, and children, young men, was murdered, slaughtered.
I don't know whether he would have married the wee girl that he was with, but I'm sure if he had married somebody, he would have had a nice family, John. But that was all blew out of the water as quick as.
I think Michael would have ended up marrying and having a family. That's what I believe. He was going steady at the time he was shot dead. And the way I look at it too as well, by the death of Michael, we have lost his children as well. You know, we lost his children, and they could be running around the streets here in Derry now. But we'll never know. We'll never know. And he got away with murder. Simple as that.
The photograph of Bishop Daly and us carrying Jackie along Chamberlain Street, it is an iconic photograph of the Troubles, but it could be anywhere where something similar had happened. It still occasionally gives me chills to see that photograph because, as I say, it was a time of extreme fear. There was also a feeling of, I felt terrible at the time because I felt incompetent I felt I hadn't done enough. But in retrospect, I suppose I could say that I'm proud I was there to mitigate the suffering.
Right now, the way I feel today, I'm as heartbroken as the day as I am when it happened. Maybe someday the funerals and that will come back to me. I've seen plenty of pictures. I've seen the picture particularly with the row of coffins in it. I'm not among them coffins. Not that it really matters that much, but that row of coffins, which one was Jackie's? I should know which one was Jackie's, but I don't. But why can't we just get that final piece of justice for them? Because Jackie has been buried for 50 years, but I want to be able to lay him to rest because that's so important. You can bury somebody, but you can't bury the truth.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
Thank you for listening. In the next episode, you will hear the families talk about the Widgery Tribunal, uniting to form the Bloody Sunday Justice Campaign, and their reactions to the findings of the Savile Inquiry.
My name is Damien Donaghy. I was 15 years of age when I was shot on Bloody Sunday by paratroopers.
My name is Charlie Glenn. I was a member of the Order of Malta Ambulance Corps in 1972, and I attended Jack Duddy after he was shot by members of the Parachute Regiment.
I'm Helen Deary. My mother's Peggy Deary, shot on Bloody Sunday, the paratroopers.
My name is Jimmy Duddy. I'm a nephew of Johnny Johnson, who was shot on Bloody Sunday.
My name's Jean Haggerty. I am the older sister of Kevin McElhinney, who died on Bloody Sunday.
My name is John Kelly, and I am the brother of Michael Kelly, one of those who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name's Eamon McCann. I was on the Bloody Sunday march.
My name is Kate McDade, the brother of Michael McDade, who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Kate Nash. My brother William was shot dead on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Kay Duddy. I'm sister of Jackie Duddy.
My name's Liam Ray. My brother Jim was murdered by British paratroopers on January the 30th, 1972, what became known as Bloody Sunday.
My name's Leo Young, brother of John Young, who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Rosalind Doyle. Brother Kevin McElhinney was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Ursula Clifford. I was a nurse treating the dead and injured on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Mickey McKinney. I'm the brother of Willie McKinney, who was murdered on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Tony Doherty. My father was executed on Bloody Sunday.
My name is Bill Rukeyser. In 1972, I was a reporter-photographer working in Northern Ireland.